Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books Network and Latin American Studies, a podcast channel of New Books Network. I'm Sharika Crawford, your host. Today I'm here with Ana Maria Reyes, who's an assistant professor in the history of Latin American art and architecture at Boston University. We're here to discuss her latest book, The Politics of Taste, Beatriz Gonzalez and Cold War Aesthetic Discourses, which was published by Duke University in 2019. Welcome to New Books Network and Latin American Studies, Ana Maria.
Thank you, Sharika, so much for this lovely invitation.
Thank you for agreeing to do the interview. I'm really looking forward to our conversation about your work on the Colombian artist Beatriz Gonzalez and her mentor, Marta Traba, as it helps readers to understand the ways in which art intersected with politics and society in mid to late 20th century Colombia. I was thinking that we might begin the interview, however, by having you talk a little bit about your intellectual or personal biography, if you will.
Sure, thank you. I'm associate professor since the last time you sent me an email, so I was just
congratulations.
Tenured. Yes, thank you. That is very exciting. My intellectual biography is actually exciting in the sense that I went to the University of Chicago. My undergraduate degree was in neurobiology, if you can believe it, neuropsychology. And it was when I realized that I was interested in human behavior, but not in putting electrodes on rats or in, you know, working in the lab or working with human subjects. And I found that history and art allowed me to study human behavior from a more comprehensive perspective. So I studied at the University of Chicago, where my intellectual journey began. And I had my advisors were incredible, and I was basically taught how to think by people like Tom Cummins, Marty Ward, W.J.T. Mitchell, Homi Bhabha, and many others who really just gave me the correct toolkit to embark on intellectual inquiry.
Well, then how did you come to this project? Why Colombia and why this particular set of artists?
I am Colombian. I was born in Colombia, and I was very interested in issues of violence because in my entire lifetime, Colombia has been going through an armed conflict. And artists, intellectuals, poets, playwrights have been very, very involved in not only representing the historical moment they experienced, but also intervening in it. And so I began working on contemporary art, but at the moment, about the year 2000, when I started my research for my dissertation, the war was escalating, and we had a president that took a hard line, and some of the artists that I was interviewing had death threats. The scholars I was interviewing had death threats. Some of them actually survived assassination attempts. So I cooled off a little bit and realized that I could be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I started to really inquire into an earlier moment of violence, which is known in Colombia as la violencia, and its immediate aftermath, which was a period of negotiating peace, very much like the one we're living right now. And I was particularly interested in how the cultural sphere negotiated all these new forces and political discourses. And so after doing quite a bit of research, Beatriz González came out in a way as the heroine of my narrative, because she created works of art that really ruffled feathers, that sparked very strong debates. And I realized that that people could say about art things that they could not say about living people. So what started to come to focus was a very rich debate about the Cold War and about social anxieties, about demographic changes that that people were willing to vent in their response to art exhibitions, but wouldn't necessarily write anonymous letters to the newspapers. So for me, it was a combination of how art functions on the imagination and how people ventriloquate through art to vent grievances. And so what came to the fore was really a portrait of a society living in a very precarious moment of the Cold War, right after the Cuban Revolution, as Colombia was the U.S.'s greatest ally in anti-communism, and as it was defending a very fragile democracy after military dictatorship and with revolutionary fervor. So it was a perfect storm. I was also really interested in contributing to Cold War scholarship, because Colombia is never discussed within that scholarship. It's been deliberate to leave Colombia outside of discourses of the Cold War, precisely because so much of it was in collaboration with the United States. And so rather than calling it a collaboration U.S.-Colombia, it was seen as a successful case of return to democracy. But really what it was is a very strong alliance of powerful interests.
It seems to me that your work is in direct conversation with a few new books relatively new books that have been out on Colombia, particularly on this period in the 1950s and 60s. One I'm thinking of is Robert Carl's Forgotten Peace, which one of my colleagues just had an interview with him. So it's now available on New Books Network and Latin American Studies, and also of Amy Offner's work, Sorting Out the Mixed Economy, this really pivotal time, as you mentioned, that has been sort of overlooked, at least in the English language scholarship on Colombia, for the reasons that you've mentioned. You said that Colombia at this time period was the U.S.'s greatest ally. In what ways do we see that sort of manifesting in this time period, which is going to lead you into kind of the art world and the responses that people had to the politics at that moment in Colombia?
So interestingly, the book is really about zooming in and out from the personal narrative, certain people and key agents, agents of change or in the government, artists, and then zooming in and out of the macro. And because of course, history is made up by individual human beings. And perhaps the one person that certainly dominates Robert Carl's book, and here in the political narrative of my book, is President Alberto Lleras Camargo. And he was not president during the time period of that I cover, which was 1964 to 1970. But he does lay the ground. He does found the National Front government, which was a coalition government, and that serves as the political infrastructural backdrop. And he's a key figure because he was the general secretary of the Pan American Union that then became the Organization of American States, serving as its first secretary general. But he was also deeply invested in the role of arts and culture. He was very close friends with Nelson Rockefeller, who was a very strong agent throughout Latin America and promoting modernism and the opening up of modern art museums. And he so he designed the National Front coalition government, and he was a modernizing force that was a fierce anti-communist. And he worked, he solicited help from Eisenhower to protect what he saw as a very fragile peace. And that's what, in many ways, what Robert Carl's book is about. But he also turned, I think the unintended consequence for was to turn the war inward, to use U.S. funds intended to protect towards external enemies, primarily the Soviet Union, to internal enemies, meaning guerrilla groups that were fighting for a whole plethora of causes. And so he's actually an important figure throughout the entire book because he's a founder of the university where Marta Traba taught, Beatriz González studied. He was a firm advocate for the modernization, including of culture and the arts. And he was a player with the turning of an armed conflict that was about the Liberal Party versus the Conservative Party to one that was about the state versus counterinsurgency forces versus insurgency forces. And so that is directly related. There are actual connections between the Rockefellers. Kennedy came to Colombia by the invitation of Alberto Lleras Camargo. Camargo, along with Joselino Kubitschek from Brazil, were important architects of the Alliance for Progress. So these are just key figures in the narrative of the era, and they are quite literally those who wove in the culture with the politics. So for me, it's relatively easy because you just have to uncover those connections, and they're there. It's not conjecture by any stretch.
So tell us a little bit about the art scene in Colombia in the years leading up, I guess, as Beatriz González is, starting to develop her own kind of art aesthetic. She's a student, and then subsequently, she will be an artist on her own right. What were the trends? What was deemed high value among Colombian elite?
So that's a great question because Colombia has an interesting history there. And the watershed moment was the arrival of Marta Traba, who was an Argentine art critic who had trained in Argentina with a modernist, Jorge Romero Brest. And then she went to Europe where she studied art history in Europe in a very, very key moment right after World War II where the hangover from the war loomed large, and certainly anxiety around fascism and the role of the masses in fascism was a primary concern. So she goes to Europe, and she meets her husband Alberto Salamea, and comes back to Colombia, married into a very important intellectual family. So her arrival basically marks the terrain in which Beatriz González's career would emerge. But prior to Marta Traba arriving, the art world and the art world debates, primarily enacted through the national salons, were in a way related to the war of la violencia, the war of conservatives versus liberals. And the way that played out in the cultural sphere is that the liberals were interested in Americanism and social realism, not socialist realism, which is a Soviet type of art, but social realism, which is much more connected to the Mexican mural program, to the federal arts program in the United States, but primarily the Mexicans. And the idea was to create a socially conscious figurative art that had very strong ties to Indo-America and to the working class, and an art that would be public. And so murals, prints, works that would be accessible beyond the elites. The conservatives, on the other hand, still valued academic art And in fact, Laureano Gomez, who was a was probably the fiercest of the conservative presidents, in fact, a fascist mind, had emulated Nazi discourse on degenerate art and rather thought of classicism as the only universal and the only, that beauty and the classical standards of beauty are the only true important universal art. So that wasn't a major impasse when Trava arrived. And when she arrived, in many ways, she functioned in tandem with Alberto Lleras Camargo, because she brought in another language that was neither the social realism of the liberals nor the classicism of the conservatives, but rather a discourse on modernism and a discourse on abstraction being an art of our times and not an art of our place, which is what the Americanists wanted, an art for our place. So at that time, roughly around the same time, the Catholic Church was also reevaluating modernism and reevaluating abstraction as a means to seek another universal, that artistic intuition was a means to access the soul, right? So in tandem, the Catholic Church is reevaluating its relationship to the art world. And they're saying, you know, abstraction is a perfectly spiritual art. So many abstract artists are seeking a spirituality. And while it may not be Catholic dogma, it is a way to understand creativity and intuition as means to understanding the human soul and approach God. So when Trava comes into Colombia, she said, Mexican muralism and social realism is political propaganda. That's kitsch. That's too close to what the Soviets and to the Nazis were doing, or Mussolini. And academic art is an art of the 19th century, not of the 20th century. We live in an era of the machine of relativity, and abstraction is the language where we can retrieve some of the spiritual loss that we have experienced through the mechanization of life. So what made her so interesting was, A, she was extremely erudite and well-spoken and articulate. She came with a degree in art history and a pedigree in being in the art world that didn't rival anybody. You know, no one could rival her in Colombia, but mostly because she was talking about modernization. And so all of a sudden, her discourse on culture gave an image to the discourse of modernization that was being propelled by the newly instituted University of Los Andes, where she would eventually teach and Beatriz González would graduate. Alberto Lleras Camargo's idea for the National Front to be a modernizing, to leave the dark ages of la violencia and enter the 20th century. So abstraction, modern arts, internationalism, all of those things resonated with a new post-World War II and post-violencia atmosphere. And so while she was extremely talented in what she did, there's no question in my mind that had she been extremely talented in a discourse that didn't line up with the National Front, with the industrial class, and with the United States, she wouldn't have been given the platform and the power that she had. So that's leading up to Beatriz González's career, at least when she really becomes an important force, you have the primary artists were all international modernists, working in abstraction, working in abstracted forms, and certainly interested in an international universal aesthetic and not a local and political aesthetic.
And You mentioned that Traba eventually becomes a mentor, but a teacher to Beatriz Gonzalez when they're both at the University of Los Andes. Could you talk a little bit about how Beatriz Gonzalez starts to respond to this kind of existing discourse of abstraction modernist art and how she comes to, as you point out in your book, challenge it in a variety of ways?
Yeah, so this is one of the most enigmatic and paradoxical aspects of Beatriz Gonzalez, because she still continues to talk like a high modernist, even though her works in many ways are what one could say the breaking into postmodernism in Colombia. So she learned art criticism and art history from Marta Traba, and those lessons stayed with her, and they still operate her aesthetic judgment today. When she was teaching, she did begin painting abstracted images. The first chapter of the book deals with a series based on a Dutch master, Johannes Vermeer, the lace maker, which is a small painting in the Louvre, but she abstracts it and does all these variations. So it's absolutely a formal, at least the way it was written about at the time, it was a formal experimentation with an artist that most modernists are fascinated by. And so even though he's obviously not a modernist, he's an early modernist, early modern painter. But it's so interesting because she flipped to the media, the mass media, to popular culture, to primarily reproductions in the press, and she started painting them in what most people would call a pop art style. Her language about her works never changed. It's still highly formalist. She still defends that the reason she picked those particular clips from the newspaper were based on formal properties. That changes with the first president after the National Front, that she starts to ridicule, and then eventually she starts to paint dirges of grief for all the loss and the next wave of violence, the one that was, unraveling as I was doing my research. But that part, that early period where she really opens up in a strong way, what we call postmodernism in Colombia, she was still completely thinking along the lines of a formalist approach. She was, it's just that she was dealing with popular culture. And in doing so, in that historical moment, whether she celebrated or not, she aroused extremely polarized reactions.
Well, her early success, as you pointed out, with the Lacemaker series brings her to prominence, brings her to the awareness of the art world. And yet she, as you kind of alluded to, but perhaps we can talk more at length about, she starts to take this turn into topics which you describe and explain as in Spanish, lo cursi, or kind of tacky, and you can kind of elaborate on that. I wanted you perhaps to talk about this first kind of direct challenge to the established norms of kind of this international kind of modernist approach to art with the Cisca's suicide works, that series that she did in her second round of kind of national acclaim.
Right. So her first series, if your readers or your listeners can imagine, the famous Vermeer lacemaker were abstracted forms of that. And she did, I can't remember off the top of my head how many canvases, but something like 13. And they're beautiful, right? They're very sophisticated. They're technically exquisite. And they deal with the canon, right? The canon of universal arts, this painting that was universally celebrated by modernists, that was rediscovered in 1918 in Paris. So that that earned her the badge of being everything that the National Front wanted culture to be, proof of a society's, of Colombian society's sophistication, proof of its international relevance and universality, and its updatedness in using abstraction as a language. And so in many ways, what the Vermeer series does, the encajeras or the lace makers do, is to legitimate that discourse and win her over. She won a very, very strong reputation as the next best thing in the art world in Colombia. So it's quite interesting that the next series that she works on is in many ways a 180 flip. In other ways, it's a continuation. If you actually look at some of the Vermeer paintings, you'll see that they're very similar in style to the painting she made called The Suicides of the Sisga Lake. So it's not a stylistic flip, it's a content flip, which is what's so interesting to me, because when you read all the literature written about the Vermeer lace makers, no one talks about the subject. They talk about the form. It's a pure formalist analysis. And the virtuosity of Beatriz González in creating abstract paintings and variations on a theme. But if you look at the very last ones that she does, ultimately called Vermirianas, which weren't part of the Museum of Modern Art exhibition, but did go on into other exhibition competitions, they're very similar. So it's not that it's not a radical departure in terms of style, but it's a radical departure in terms of subject matter. So while the first series is based on what is considered a quote-unquote universal masterpiece, a work of art whose value has been legitimated through Western art history, newspaper report, and not even just any newspaper report, a yellow press, something like the National Enquirer, of a couple that had committed suicide and left a suicide note where the man says that they committed suicide to liberate her from sin. And so this is a gardener and his girlfriend who was a domestic worker. And it's more likely a homicide suicide than a double suicide. And so interestingly, this happens. Beatriz González sends the first of her series of suicides to the National Salon. And so that was highly outrageous to think of taking something from the yellow press, something from like National Enquirer, and elevating it to the stature of the National Salon, and hence history painting, right? This suicide is now in a relatively large format and presented as in the National Salon as a sort of a revision of the history genre. So that in and of itself was outrageous and in many ways opened up the doors for artists to look to mass culture, urban mass culture, not, you know, folkloric, artisanal, rural, peasant culture. And, but also in what I argue in that chapter that I have no doubt influenced people's responses is that the newspapers were absolutely filled with op-eds and reports on the population council meeting that had taken place 2 weeks earlier, where again, Alberto Lleras Camargo, this president who looms, overtly and covertly throughout the entire book, was declaring that the only true humane antidote to a Cuban revolution in a country with extreme poverty like Colombia is the birth control pill. Right. So women's reproductive rights, and actually that's an anachronism because no one discussed women or their rights. It was all about birth control as population control was being discussed in the press fervently in the country that prided itself as being the most Catholic country in the world prior to the papal pronunciation on birth control. That a woman a couple would have committed suicide to preserve the woman's honor would be then described by the word cursi. So the whole book really revolves around this word cursi, which is used from that moment on to characterize Beatriz González's work. This is not a word that she uses. It's the word that just she becomes pegged and characterized, and it becomes a signature for her, not her own signature, but the label that Marta Traba and everybody else begin to applaud her as the painter of the cursi. Now, the cursi is a really interesting word, and I spent quite a bit of time in the introduction unpacking it, because sometimes Traba eventually uses the word kitsch as a synonym, as a translation, but that's not a good translation, because kitsch has a whole theoretical apparatus associated with it that is a reaction to the malleability through mass culture of the masses in Nazi Germany. And so here, cursi has a connotation of behavior. So a cursi behavior is one that is excessive and lowbrow, excessive, overly sentimental. And it's a word that's typically associated with ridiculing both women and the lower classes. So by calling the works that Beatriz González did cursi, it really kind of revealed the fact, the anxieties that these works were unleashing in terms of both demographic changes or social changes in social norms for women, as well as the demographic changes of the population, which had everybody quite nervous about a Cuban-inspired revolution.
I think what's so striking and very persuasive is how you lay out those two arguments. So the first first chapter, where you're talking about the lacemaker series and the kind of welcoming that she does receive from kind of the established art world and those who consume, you know, this kind of art. It's viewed as high culture art, even though it's in this, you know, kind of abstraction form, because of the content is deemed acceptable. And then her next major kind of series of work is very controversial because of the subject matter, which reminds, as you point out in that chapter really very effectively over the population control, how it just reminds people of the anxieties of change in particular cities like Bogota, the capital, where you're having rural to urban, you know, migration and changes, you know, after La Violencia with the downtown city. And I just thought, when you read them back to back, I mean, your argument really comes out, and you do see, as you pointed out earlier, that paradoxical kind of positioning of González. And yet, she now has this kind of whole, you know, lexicon being labeled now onto her work, and she moves forward with it. And I was particularly struck by your chapter on the polarization over the portraits that she did of the founding fathers of Colombia. Our listeners are probably more familiar with one of the two, Simón Bolívar. Also you have Francisco de Santa, de Paula Santander. And I would like for you to kind of talk about how her move into different types of content continues to kind of, you know, amp up the polarizing comments around her work.
Yeah, so in many ways, her different subject matters irritate a whole new cast of characters. You know, when she starts to paint. She paints for the 1967 National Salon. She paints a tin diptych painted on enamel with enamel paint on oval tins of the two founding fathers in Colombia. So this idea of the the liberals and conservatives, you know, going into taking the 19th century wars into the 20th century is very much seen as a foundational myth. It's sort of Cain and Abel story in Colombia, where Simón Bolívar, who was from Venezuela, but he was the military man and he was an authoritarian figure. He was known as the man of difficulties. Whereas Francisco de Paula Santander, who was his vice president, but during the liberation campaign was actually acting president, he was considered, you know, the man of laws and more of a federalist. And so there's sort of a lot of mythology around them being the founders of the two political parties, even though none of this really adds up to the historical record. It's more of a mythology. So when she takes these two foundational figures and she puts them on enamel paints onto tin, very much like the informal signage that was popping up all through Bogota with all what people called invasions, which were the flight that characterized the whole world with industrialization, but in Colombia exacerbated by the war and the violence in the countryside, where the face of Bogota was changing entirely because of all these newcomers, the city's girth expanding at incredible velocity. In fact, Colombia went, during this period, Colombia basically went from being a primarily rural society to being a primarily urban society. And so the anxiety around who is a rightful citizen of Bogota, right? Who are the real Bogotanos versus who are the newcomers, was something that was palpable. So to paint these forefathers, these sacred figures, in a style reminiscent of the informal commerce that was popping up due to this demographic change, really, really offended, especially the conservatives, because the conservatives see Simón Bolívar as their particular is their founding father specifically, but also because Simón Bolívar had been used recently by the Soviets, the Cubans, Tito, and other leftist governments. And so there was this general sense that Simón Bolívar was being hijacked by the left of the world. And so So that's a really interesting part of it. Again, this is one of those moments where Beatriz González's work is a catalyst for the venting of grievances that were much greater than the accusation of plagiarism that is, you know, that is waged against her. So, I actually published an edited volume of essays just on Simón Bolívar, and partly coming from this realization that Simón Bolívar was a completely floating signifier during the Cold War. And he lands in different places on different parts of this. But, you know, in Venezuela, he's always been a liberal leader. In Colombia, he was a conservative leader until the guerrillas took him up and took up his unfulfilled cause as their cause. And so it's a fascinating moment for the icon. So Beatriz González plays with that icon, right? And she presents him not only on enamel on tin, but like Sergeant Pepper's Lonely, right? Just a couple of months after Sergeant Pepper's was released by the Beatles. So this was really, I think, being a provocateur. And in being a provocateur, she provoked, and people responded with outrage, anonymous letters, declarations from, you know, the general editor of the conservative newspaper. It was a splash, and that's exactly what made her work so powerful, that she was able to collapse the sacred cows with profane materials. And out of that detonation came out all of these anxieties about rapid changes that were happening and people's discomfort with them.
And yet you pointed out both really briefly in your response, but much more so in the chapter, how not only was the response powerful and in many ways agitated towards this kind of reclaiming or misusing of Simón Bolívar's kind of iconography, you know, his symbolism, but it actually had the potential to damage her burgeoning art career with these allegations of plagiarism. And that's where you re-enter Marta Traba into this kind of account. So perhaps you could speak to the listeners a little bit about how Marta Traba really plays a pivotal role, not just as a mentor, but as someone who can help, you know, salvage what is starting to get a little bit out of hand in terms of thinking about this particular set of artwork.
Yeah. So, but Marta Traba is an incredibly powerful figure in Colombian art history. And she does come up as a heroine in this book because she was such a supporter of Beatriz González to the point that Beatriz González actually helped her reformulate her own theories about art. It's a much more complicated, long story. But the reality is that Marta Traba was way too powerful and she could make or break careers. So her endorsement secured Beatriz González's career for sure. I don't necessarily think Beatriz González's career in 1967 was in jeopardy because I think the conservatives had already discredited those last ones, you know, who were really standing up for classicism in the 1960s and 70s weren't really, they didn't have a much impact into the course of the art world for sure, because it was an internationalizing art world, a world where artists were going to biennials in Sao Paulo or in Argentina or in Venice or working in New York. So there wasn't, I wouldn't say that those scandals ever jeopardized her career. In fact, she thought it was ridiculous for me to even mention it in a book because she thought it was so inconsequential. But what was so fascinating was to retrieve the anxiety that her works, what are the dimensions that really, really ruffled feathers with the conservatives. And so that was what was interesting to me, was to see how Colombia was changing at an incredibly rapid pace. And people were very anxious about it. They didn't really quite know how to put language to it. But her works gave enough of a detonation where people could vent about how they felt about that art that discloses greater things. But Marta Traba, just to answer your question more briefly, she was very powerful at this time, but she's eventually, around this time in 1967, she's actually kicked out of Colombia, then asked to come back in capacity as mother of Colombians, but no longer capable of interfering in education. She continues to write, but eventually this is a moment where it's more Marta Traba's career that takes a spin downwards in Colombia than it is Beatriz González's.
How does Beatriz González, you know, how does she develop as an artist past this critical period where the peace efforts are leading now to a renewed period of violence, now with kind of armed groups spurring both in cities and in the countryside, as Colombia engages in a larger kind of civil war, civil conflict? How do we position Beatriz González in the 70s and 80s moving forward?
Well, so in the 70s and the early 80s, she was still engaging with her really, really caustic humor, right? So her works are unforgiving in their humor. And she directed that humor with the election of the president, I'm sorry, it's escaping me, Gabriel Turbay Ayala, and Julio César, Turbay Ayala. And he, you know, he comes in and he, you know, he was kind of ridiculed because he had a very nasal voice. He wore bow ties and he was seen as an incredibly corrupt president who people just had no had no respect for, certainly not in Bogota. And interestingly, he also introduces color television to Colombia, and that's in the early 80s. So she starts to play with this idea of Turbay as kind of a circus act now in full color. And so she basically had her turning point is 1985 when the military took over the Palace of Justice. And when that happened, she changes her tenor, and she, you know, she goes from being kind of a gesture court painter in a way, not court painter, but like a ridicule. She's definitely trying to provoke. She's a provocateur. And that would be the best way I could say between the time where she moves beyond the Vermeer paintings and the time where she's painting Turbay Ayala's portraits, she's really provoking. She's trying to make art that unsettles, trying to make art that that sparks strong reactions. And she's extremely successful at doing that. After 1985, she goes into a lamentation. And so her works, while they still have some of the key characteristics of her previous works, which is to work from photographs of the press, and with colors that perhaps seem a little out of place, right? And I talk about that in chapter 2. So she paints with really bright turquoises and yellows and very strong colors, but she's now painting dirges of lamentation for all the lives that are being lost. And I think in that way, she's moving again to another revision of the historical genre. So she sees how these press images are, they capture and they fix in an image all the loss and the pain that Colombians are experiencing, but they're fleeting because people forget the next day and they move on. So for her to be able to put them into the historical genre of painting is a way to really give them the gravitas that they deserve, right? All this pain and the suffering, and not just a fleeting image in the press or a statistic, but really to give. And a lot of the images are, instead of dead bodies, some of them are, but a lot of them are the lamentations of mothers. And as a mother of a son who, you know, was of age to be drafted by the military, she felt incredible empathy for so many mothers who were losing their children to this war. So it's a completely different tenor. Again, her style doesn't entirely change. She goes back to painting oil on canvas, and she becomes less of a provocateur and more of a history painter, if you know, that would be my characterization. But again, you know, she has her own. And my book really has more to do with how her form interacted with institutions and with the viewers who felt compelled to say something about it. So I haven't done that kind of extensive research onto responses of her later career.
Where could we find examples of her work, either in Colombia or it may be even in the United States? Are there museums that hold maybe a few of her pieces in their larger collections?
Yes. Actually, in the United States, the Museum of Modern Art has her work. She's actually a prolific print artist as well. So you'll actually be able to find probably a lot of her prints in more museums that I'm aware of. Because, of course, with works on paper, you usually store them and only exhibit them for little bits of time because of the fragility of the paper. But the big pieces, the MFAH owns the Bolivar bed. The MoMA owns, I believe, Canción de Cuna, which is a baby crib with Baby Johnson painted in the middle. I'm trying to think. The Blanton Museum of the University of Texas, I believe, owns one of her vanities. And there are, and the Tate Museum bought her Last Supper, her last, her last table, which is a painting of the Leonardo's Last Supper onto a table. I'd have to think some more, but she's actually becoming, she just had a retrospective that, that was at the MFAH at the Pérez Art Museum in Miami, and I believe the MUAC in Mexico. So, and her works were in the Radical Women exhibition at Pacific Standard Time, as well as Home, which I believe was in MoCA. Anyways, so those exhibitions, you know, have their works in catalogs. But she does have a catalog resume online, and you can retrieve any of her works. Every single one of them is cataloged in through the University of Los Andes catalog resume.
What was she like? I get the impression maybe you met her at least once or more. And what did she think about your project?
Do I have to answer that question?
No, you do not. But you did get a chance to meet her, though. Am I correct?
Oh, yes. I have about 12 hours of interviews with her. I have known her for many, many years. She's not a fan of my book because she's, like I said, paradoxically, I think she still believes that art speaks for itself. And my contextualizing a historical moment really reduces the her work. She sees it as she's accused me of illustrating history with her work, but what I do is something completely different, right? I'm a historian that shows works of art as players and protagonists within that narrative. Now, I have no claims to say that my book will tell you what those works mean. What my book does is say that's what that work meant to that person at that moment. And this is what was happening simultaneously. And this is the building that it was exhibited in. So what I do is really show that people engage works of art in an intellectual and emotional level that's highly mediated by their historical moments or socioeconomic position and so many other things. But what using her as a narrative thread was able to do was to show some of the shifting discourses that were happening in Colombia. Now, what her works mean, well, she, I think, wants to believe that her works have intrinsic meaning that are very closely aligned to what her intentions were. But I don't, you know, that wasn't the book that I wrote. I wasn't trying to decipher her intentions. The only thing I did was speculate that she was trying to provoke people because she was successful at doing that. But I was really looking at a historical moment and looking at how her works are key protagonists of that era and that they reveal to us things that we could not find from other source documents. You know, going into the National Archives and reading the letters that Alberto Lleras Camargo sent to Nelson Rockefeller or to John F. Kennedy are not enough to give us a sense of the cultural manifestations of that very tense moment, fraught with anxieties about overpopulation, about revolutionary fervor, about changing social norms, about you know, the changing faces of cities, and her works of art were able to unleash people's responses that reveal those anxieties.
So Ana Maria, what are you currently working on? Do you have an ongoing or a new project underway?
Yes, I'm working on a second book, and it's a book called, it's a third book, I suppose. It's a book on symbolic reparations and the peace process in Colombia. Mm. And so what I'm looking at is a whole range of different forms of commemorations that have been either brokered through the Inter-American system of human rights or have been brokered by some of the transitional justice institutions that have been put in place or have been independent artists that have worked on them or grassroots organizations, and really thinking about the issue of aesthetics of memorialization in these processes of trying to move beyond war into peace. And so, you know, I've written quite a bit already about some examples, and hopefully if I learn the right lessons, maybe have something to say about how we can think about memorialization as a form of peace building.
Well, I know I look forward to that, and I'm sure many of our listeners do too. Thank you so much for the interview, Ana Maria.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm so happy to have an audience.
You can find a link to The Politics of Taste, Beatriz Gonzalez, and Cold War Aesthetics on New Books Network and Latin American Studies channel. Until next time.